Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota State Legislative Session moves into February, and SDPB brings you gavel-to-gavel coverage, daily reporting, a daily State House podcast, and in-depth analysis of the debates and the decisions. Today, our journalists gather from across the state for a roundtable update. Seth Tupper is SDPB's business and economic development reporter, and he's joining us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Black Hills studio. Seth, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Lee Strubinger is SDPB's politics and public policy reporter, and he's with us from the Capitol building in Pierre. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Lori.
And Jackie Hendry is the host of South Dakota Focus, and she's joining us today from the Kirby Family Studio. That's inside SDPB's Sioux Falls space. Hey, Jackie.
Hi, Lori.
I want to start with Seth today because there are some things that we've talked about a little bit before and some new things on the radar. Let's talk about this effort for meat processing grants, something that a lot of South Dakotans are tuned into because of some of those shortages we saw early on in the pandemic.
Yeah, if you recall in the spring when the country was hit by the pandemic, the Smithfield pork plant in Sioux Falls shut down temporarily when a lot of its workers grew sick with COVID-19. Other plants around the country also had temporary shutdowns or slowed down drastically. And that resulted in some shortages at grocery stores of meat. Either the meat was gone or it was scarce on shelves. And so people turned to their local lockers or other small meat processors to try to find that meat. And those local lockers and local meat processors were quickly overrun by the demand and had trouble keeping up. So what this bill would do, House Bill 1040, would basically allocate $5 million from state funds for the Department of Agriculture to give out as grants so that small meat lockers could add equipment, expand things like coolers, smokers, other equipment to process meat more efficiently, or just process more meat. And Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden testified on the bill.
We have an opportunity here to fill the gaps in our meat handling capacity, strengthening our food supply chain, and grow our local businesses. We can also help promote South Dakota raised products in the process.
All right, so where is this bill at in the process of the legislative process there?
It was approved unanimously last week by the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, so now it goes on to the full House of Representatives.
All right, so tell us a little bit about one of the questions we were asking early on was, you know, if you increase this capacity and it's not during a pandemic, you also need to increase, you know, the markets or the ability for these new facilities or expanded facilities to sell to people across state lines. Tell us a little bit about what you know about why that can't happen now.
Yeah, it's interesting. You would think it's kind of weird, you know, if we have a state-inspected meat product, why can't somebody sell that meat? You know, if you have a customer in Minnesota and you want to ship that meat there, Right. Why can't you do that? Well, it's very difficult right now and impossible in some cases because of federal law. And this all goes back to the early 1900s and some of the problems that the country had in meat plants in Chicago with unsafe conditions and unsafe food. And that was all dramatized in the novel The Jungle in 1906. And I talked to the state veterinarian, Dustin Odekoven, and he explained that situation.
So The Jungle is like the genesis of the Federal Meat Inspection Act. And certainly at that time, you know, you had some bad dudes in Packertown there in Chicago. And they were not, I mean, you had company guys that were supposedly doing the inspection, but they were reworking stuff in the basement and all that kind of stuff, you know. All that stuff, you know, and then so from there they said, you know, state inspection, city inspection, you guys are not doing what needs to be done. We're going to put this all under the federal government.
Bad dudes in Packertown. All right, times have changed. It's not perfect, but times have definitely changed since Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle in 1906, right?
Exactly. So Odekoven says there's really no difference in food safety between, you know, South Dakota's state inspection anymore and the federal inspections. And so that's why it's frustrating for a lot of people and a lot of producers and local meat processors that they can't, you know, ship their product over state lines. So there is a bill in Congress that the South Dakota delegation supports that would change that and allow for shipment and sale of meat across state lines. But there is opposition to that. The Federal Meat Inspectors Union has been opposed to that because obviously that would, you know, make their inspections a little less important if states are going to assume more of that role. And also some of the national meat groups have opposed that because there are apparently some export agreements that are predicated on the meat being federally inspected, and if any state inspected meat gets into that supply, that could cause some problems with the export agreements.
Interesting. You're also looking into House Bill 1029. Tell me a little bit about this one.
Yeah, this one was actually heard at the same hearing as the meat processor grants in the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, and it caught my ear because I had reported back in November on the Lawrence County Commission rejecting a controversial request to mine for gold near the rim of Spearfish Canyon. And that plan or plans like it had been floating around for a long time, for many years, and it could still resurface. But anyway, during that debate, one of the things that was said was that this company proposing the mine did not plan to process their gold ore on site. They plan to take it off site somewhere, although they didn't know where yet, but to some sort of standalone ore processing facility. And so last week, Mike Lees of the Department of Environment and Natural Resources testified on this bill, 1029, and he said that the DENR has been contacted about the possibility of somebody opening a standalone ore processing facility.
This would be the first of its kind in South Dakota. The proposed commercial facility would receive precious metal ore from other mines, crush the ore, use cyanide to extract gold and silver from the ore, and then dispose of the mine tailings in a large impoundment.
So I'll jump in and say here that what was discovered, the problem was DENR found that apparently our state laws don't contemplate standalone ore processing facilities. So this is a loophole where if a standalone ore processing facility opened up, it could actually go unregulated right now. And Mike Lees explained this bill 1029 tries to close that loophole.
This bill clarifies the definition of mining operation to ensure any standalone chemical ore milling activities are subject to the same stringent environmental safeguards as similar milling activities at a typical large-scale gold mine.
It's those little things, isn't it, Seth? What happens with this one next?
This one was also approved unanimously by the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, so it's going on to the full House of Representatives.
Interesting. Thanks for that. Jackie Hendry, you've been looking into, for the next South Dakota Focus, thoughts on the Ochechi Shakowin essential understandings. Tell us a little bit. Well, first of all, how long have you been looking at this particular story? You've been following it for quite some time, yeah?
Right. That is true, Lori Walsh, because I find it especially interesting. This is very similar to a bill that was brought last legislative session. Senator Troy Hinert, a big part of that. But really, this legislation over the past couple years, I've been hearing rumblings about it because for a few different reasons. First of all, listeners may be interested in noting that South Dakota is one of very few, I think maybe three states in the nation, that does not have any kind of legislative framework for charter schools. So this idea of schools outside of that kind of public district sphere with perhaps a specialized viewpoint or curriculum or something like this. A handful of indigenous folks in South Dakota are taking the Ochechi Shakowin Essential Understandings, which is, you can look it up online. It's on the Department of Education website. It's basically a set of curriculum outlining at all kinds of grade levels certain things that South Dakotans should know and understand about the Ochechi Shakowin, the indigenous people, Lakota, Dakota, Nakota, traditionally from this region. It encompasses things like language, histories, treaty obligations, a whole lot of information that in many people's perspective is not highlighted to the extent they might wish it was in South Dakota K through 12 schools. So yes. The bill this year is Senate Bill 68. It's passed through a Senate Education Committee. It's actually on the calendar for the Senate floor today. This bill last year received unanimous support from the Senate, ultimately failing in a House committee. So that's the plan for our next South Dakota focus, is to really track where this bill is, go a little more in depth into where it does or doesn't fit with, or I should say expands on, state education standards that we've already talked about quite a bit this session, and will continue to.
I want to jump in and ask you this for clarification, because you said we're one of the few states that doesn't have charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
So you take a, you know, and we've heard opposition to the Chedi-Shakwin Essential Understandings, you know, Senate Bill 68 from the Rapid City School District because of how it would affect their school district. They believe that the curriculum can be incorporated into the, you know, the regular curriculum that they have. You know, I'm from Sioux Falls, mm-hmm. so there are schools such as the, you know, Spanish language immersion school and the, you know, Eugene Field A plus arts school, but those are not charter schools. Those
right.
are not. What exactly is a charter school in other states, Jackie, for the people in South Dakota who think that, you know, some of these specialized schools are serving or functioning as charter schools? There's a big difference between the two.
Right. And but before I get to that kind of definition, I think it's kind of this, my understanding of charter schools is this publicly funded but independent school established by teachers or a community or something like this. But I think part of the arguments in favor of the Chedi-Shakwin schools specifically is that hasn't happened in their district yet. While Rapid City might argue we have the ability to create a Lakota immersion school, they haven't yet. And so this bill is being supported in especially last year, I recall a whole lot of parents saying, listen, I smudge with my students before the school day, and my son was called into the office because the predominantly white school administration thought he smelled like weed. And like, that's an example of a certain lacking of cultural understanding. While the districts may possess an ability to respond to that now, they haven't. So these communities are hoping to set forth on their own to make it happen rather than waiting on the existing school districts that haven't done it yet.
Does this legislation open the door for other kinds of charter or magnet schools across the state? Or is it focused on this particular aspect?
This bill is specific to the Chedi-Shakwin community-based schools. I imagine it probably would open the door for other charter schools. I haven't heard that complaint specifically, but this specific bill specifically says Chedi-Shakwin community-based schools and seeks to set up funding and creation for those.
Yeah, complaint or opportunity. I guess it
right.
depends on what you would like to see in South Dakota, whether you want art schools or things like that. They could use this as an argument to move forward on that. But you're also looking at and watching a whole heap of education bills that
yes.
are coming through, and a lot of them are sort of revealing how divisive even talking about what we teach our students can be right now.
Right. And there's a group of three bills that caught my attention. All three of them just introduced this past Thursday, so just a few days old, mm-hmm. not been heard in committee yet. What I'm probably going to tackle along with the Chedi-Shakwin community-based schools is House Bill 1187, an act to require schools to provide instruction on South Dakota's tribal history, culture, and government. So that prime sponsor is Representative Sean Bordeaux from District 26A, which includes much of the Rosebud Reservation. He frequently is another legislator that brings bills related to indigenous issues. This bill, if I can pull up the text really quick, it specifically calls on any schools to collaborate with federally recognized Indian tribes to the extent possible that are located within the school district or that might be neighboring the school district to improve materials about Indian tribes. And so this is another aspect where I imagine the debate is going to turn to what's in the state standards, what's the complaint there.
Right. And then you also have these Phil Jensen legislation, which is talking about prohibiting the use of curricular materials that promotes racial divisiveness
mm-hmm.
and displaces historical understanding with ideology. He's kind of thinking about the 1619 Project as an area that he's targeting, but one has to wonder how these things intersect in a state like South Dakota, at least on the debate floor.
Exactly. And then speaking of intersection, just real quick, I want to touch on one more bill that has just dropped today. Senate Bill 166, outside of the education sphere specifically, but this is a bill to revise provisions regarding hate crimes in South Dakota. This prime sponsor is Senator Red Dawn Foster, and this would add certain groups under, I guess you would say, protection against hate crimes. And those groups that this bill would add protection for are based on actions against a person's sexual orientation, gender identity, or identification as a Native American Two-Spirit. Those would be the additional groups to receive protection. And I haven't talked to Senator Foster, but I would be surprised if this bill wasn't in some way related or a response to the birth certificate bill that I know we're going to hear about soon.
Right. So let's bring Lee Strubinger. He's at the Capitol, and he's we're going to talk more in our second hour about HB 1076, which is a bill to ban the amending of birth certificates for transgender people. Lee, tell us a little bit about what you're watching for on that legislation this week.
Yeah, I'm definitely waiting for it to be scheduled right now. So it's been moved. It's had its first reading on the Senate floor, which each bill has to get two hearings before it can be two readings before it gets voted on. And so after the first reading, House Bill 1076 got moved to Senate Health and Human Services. They met this morning. That bill did not come up, and it has not, they have not released the agenda for Wednesday's meeting, and they're also meeting on Friday. They meet Monday, Wednesday, Friday. This week is a 5-day work week for the state legislature. So they have two other meetings coming up. It could be scheduled then. We haven't seen yet what's going to happen when that bill, when it's going to be heard yet. So that's kind of really what I'm waiting for at this point.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what you are noticing happening. You know, obviously there's a supermajority of Republicans in the State House, but that doesn't mean they all think with the same minds. Tell me a little bit, you know, in this grander scheme of things, what you're noticing about working together or dividing and splitting apart.
Sure. I think this is the House Bill 1076 really revealed sort of how the House Republicans in particular approach these kind of fringe social issues. You know, this is something that would prevent, you know, transgender people from amending their birth certificate after they transition. And so in my mind, first thing that I wanted to know was how often has this happened? And I reached out to the unified judicial system here, and we got about 14 different cases of this happening within the last 5 to 6 years. And so it's not a widespread thing that is happening in South Dakota. And so a lot of the proponents of this bill, supporters of it, spoke in favor of it and really voted on that. We didn't hear a lot of opposition debate on the House floor. We did hear State Representative Jess Olson talk about the last section of the bill, which I won't go into here, but was very concerned about sort of government intrusion into sort of private personal decisions. But I think what this vote like really sort of outlined is how two different factions of the House Republicans, how they approach these kinds of social issues, whereas they might, you know, come together on other things when it comes to these types of bills, how the House is sort of split in that kind of way.
Yeah. We're going to hear more about that in hour two of In the Moment. For now, we're going to have to wrap up. Lots more to cover in the days ahead. Lee Strubinger, Seth Tupper, and Jackie Hendry, thanks so much.
Thanks, Lori.
Great. Good to be here.